right. Hello again. Nice to see you. I was looking, last week we were in Song of Songs. Job is about five times longer. I am not going to go five times as long today, but I am going to dive right in. As a reminder, the structure for these 3 weeks is looking at Old Testament wisdom literature, the Ketuvim, and specifically looking at three different books in the Ketuvim for wisdom. In wisdom, I think struck me last week, it struck me again this week, is not a step-by-step how to paint by numbers way through life. Oftentimes, it is the right kinds of questions to ask or the right things to seek in the midst of complicated situations. And the structure we are using here is Song of Songs. We opened last week with what is it, how should we think about desire, these passions that we find in us. This week, we're going to let those passions run right into the wall of real life, and we're going to talk about Job and suffering, and then try to put it all together next week with Ecclesiastes. And suffering is many things. It is experienced many different ways. It has many different causes. It's hard to capture all of them here, but there's a type of suffering that we won't talk much about today. I'll just highlight it at the beginning, because there's a certain kind of suffering that we bring upon ourselves. I saw this most clearly in myself. You can tell kind of my age of education when I was going through fourth, fifth, and sixth grade, because during those years, the best thing that you could do in class was go to the computer lab. We went to the computer lab to learn how to type and stuff like that, but the real reason you went to the computer lab was Oregon Trail. Oregon Trail was incredible. And we would play Oregon Trail, and I imagine if my teacher actually watched the choices I made in Oregon Trail, she would have been horrified. She would have feared for the future, because I would go to Independence, Missouri, I would go to the shops, and they had medicine, and they had food, and I didn't buy any of that. I bought bullets. I bought, like, all the bullets. Every single bullet I could find in Missouri, I loaded into my wagon, and I set off for Oregon. And then on the way, you had some options. You could pick how fast you would go and how much you would feed the people. And I always picked grueling pace, meager rations. I would just go right in and just set grueling pace, meager rations. The meager rations was fine. I didn't buy any food, so that was to kind of set. But we went fast. And all I ever did was hunt. When you hunted, you could shoot the buffalo, but they would cap you out at 2,000 pounds of buffalo shot, and you could only carry 200 back to your wagon. So I would shoot 200 pounds of buffalo, or 2,000 pounds of buffalo, leave 980 pounds, or everything except for the 200 pounds. I would leave 1,800 pounds in the field, go back into the wagon, lock it up, grueling pace, meager rations. And then I would get notifications like Samuel has dysentery, and Rebecca got bit by a rattlesnake, and I would just go. And eventually we'd get to the river at the end, and it would say, all right, do you want to cross the river? You want to go literally 100 yards to the bridge. I was like, we're crossing the deepest part. And I would just go. And then we would get wrecked on the rocks, and I would just start all over again. If you looked at the people in Oregon Trail, they suffered. Rebecca and Samuel suffered. But they suffered because of horrible choices I was making. Right? I don't want to get into that. There's a realm of that kind of suffering that we bring about ourselves. But I want to talk about Job, who is a righteous sufferer. Actually, you probably could say that Rebecca and Samuel maybe were closer to Job than the pain I bring upon myself, but Job is in a category of the righteous who suffer, and we see it throughout the New Testament even. In James, we hear, hey, you've heard of Job. You've heard of his perseverance. That kind of perseverance is good. And in the Old Testament, when God is threatening to destroy wicked nations, he says these nations are so wicked that even if Noah, Daniel, and Job lived there, they could only save themselves, not even their families. That's how wicked things have become. But Job is held up as not someone who is necessarily reaping his bad choices, but is actually quite righteous in his persevering through suffering anyway. So we're going to start off with who is Job. Who is this person who we see in other places in the Bible as an example we should follow? First of all, he's not an Israelite. The book of Job, we think, is pretty old, and in it, we hear that he is from the land of Uz, or Uz. Let me say Uz. We think he's not an Israelite, or it's very old, for a couple of reasons. One is he seems to act as his own household priest. When he when his children go out and they have kind of parties, he offers sacrifices in case something bad happened, right? So he is offering sacrifices. There's no mention of the sanctuary. We are told that he is the greatest among all the people of the East. Once again, not an Israelite, but he seems to think like one. We're going to unpack this a little bit, but when you look at the way Job approaches his life, he approaches his life very much like an Israelite would, even though we're told he is not one. And Job, his book, brings up a couple big questions, and I need you to hold these today. We're going to come back to them, one at the end and one throughout the whole time, but Job gives us two questions, and I'm going to hand these to you, but be careful, especially with the first one. This is a question that I have seen people hold on to so tightly their whole lives, they have had no room to hold on to anything else. The two questions that Job is going to bring up, I think when you read, is one, why does God allow innocent people to suffer? It's a big question. And number two, how should we respond when people are suffering? That one, the second, we'll go throughout the whole time. We'll give some options. Question number one is big. We're not going to even try to address that one until God has a chance to come in and speak. So these are old questions. They are questions in Job, but they were not new questions. People at the time had been asking questions like that. Why do people who seem good seem to suffer? And in order to understand why Job is a little bit different than the way those questions were being answered at the time, I have to first give you a term that I pulled from a study Bible. I like it, but it describes how people in that area tended to think of their relationship for them to the gods. Right? So this was a way people would think, oh, there's gods and there's us. Here's how we interact. And it's called in that text, the great symbiosis. The great symbiosis says that gods have needs, they get hungry, they need prestige, they need to be known, they need to be worshipped, and humans need to be protected. And so kind of like the birds on the back of the wildebeests, we have found out how to get along. That there's a give and take, there's a reciprocity. So if you're not meeting God's needs, or the gods' needs, then the gods get hangry, and they yell at you, and they punish you until you give them more food. Or maybe you're not meeting the gods' needs, but things are going well. Well, be nervous because the God who was watching your back is not going to anymore because you're not giving him what he wants. And some people think they're meeting the gods' needs, but they get punished for something. And then the thought was, well, I must have accidentally done something bad. I must have accidentally stepped on a sacred site. So you would just go out and you would do every ritual you could to try to appease whatever wrong you had did. You didn't know what it was. You just tried to make the god happy again. But in the end, it was believed that the gods were sensible. If you met their needs, why wouldn't they keep you around? And so this was the thought. And you see a lot of people, why are you suffering? The question is, well, are you neglecting the gods and they're mad? Or have you offended them accidentally, and then you better figure out some way to unoffend them? That was the thinking at the time. And right at the beginning, we see this. We see Job set out on a different course because the great symbiosis is a world of orthopraxy, but not orthodoxy. What that means is the great symbiosis is in a world where you better do the right thing, but it doesn't really matter if you understand it. Your beliefs don't have to be right, just your actions. As long as you put the food in the right place, it doesn't really matter what you think about the process. That's the world that Job is taking place in. But Job is not like that. He will not be like that. Right from the get-go, we get at the very beginning, we get a story about Job. He's very rich. He has everything he needs. He has 7 sons, 3 daughters. He makes careful not to offend God in any way. Right, this is a familiar story. He offers a sacrifice just in case the gods were offended. This almost sounds like the great symbiosis, right? This would have been familiar to anybody. And then we get a picture in a throne room. One day, God is sitting on the throne. I can read it for you here. One day, the angels came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came with them. The Lord said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" Satan answered the Lord, from roaming throughout the earth, going back and forth on it. Then the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? There is no one like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil. Does Job fear God for nothing? Satan replied. Have you not put a hedge around him and his household and everything he has? You have blessed the work of his hands, so that his flocks and herds are spread throughout the land. But now stretch out your hand and strike everything he has, and he will surely curse you to your face. The Lord said to Satan, very well, that everything he has is in your power, but on the man himself do not lay a finger. Then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. This happens twice. The first time, Job loses his family, his flocks, everything like that, but he stays faithful. And then the second time, he is stricken with his health. And that's kind of what's going. That's the setup of the story. Now, this story here, a couple things to start. The term there, Satan, when you go back to the language it is written in, it's actually hard to know exactly what that means. Satan is a proper name for the devil. It's used often in like Revelation in the New Testament. But here, the word that we see is ha-satan, I'm guessing. The Satan. The word the before is almost never used. I don't think it is ever used to indicate a name. In fact, it says the one who is accusing or opposing. And in fact, this term ha-satan is used throughout the Old Testament to refer to different people. At one point, it's used to refer to David, King David, when the Philistine says, don't bring him with us when we fight. He's going to turn against and oppose us. There's the ha-satan. It's used in kings when you hear about foreign armies. You know, like they'll all fall away. There won't be anyone to oppose us. And even the angel of the Lord, who is standing in front of Balaam and his donkey, when he blocks the way, is referred to as a ha-satan, an opposer. So right off the bat, and the reason I bring this up is because I'm not sure we are talking about the kind of suffering that is evilly motivated in this case either. You actually get a little bit of a picture of what's happening here is just someone says, hey, isn't Job just playing by the great symbiosis? Right? If you look to last week, we said you're looking for the God in the fire. It's the accusation that God doesn't burn with, or Job doesn't burn with passion for God. He just warms himself by God's fire. So the accusation here is not to tempt or destroy Job, but to say, hey, actually, what if Job is just doing this because of what he gets? It might be evilly motivated, but we don't have to jump to that conclusion. And sometimes when we see suffering in the world, we're tempted to jump to the conclusion that something is evil is happening, but it sometimes just seems to be suffering. We're going to come back to this at the end. And confusing above all, that first question, why does God allow innocent people to suffer? God says, very well, do it. God's okay with it. He's allowing this to happen. So off the bat, we get the picture here, not that Job is necessarily being evilly attacked, but Job is being allowed to suffer. And those can be different things. They won't always be different things. There's a time we won't suffer, but here in the world tainted by sin, there just sometimes is suffering. So, question number two. How should we respond when people are suffering? Job is now suffering. And we're going to start trying to answer this question. When we see Job suffer, what should we do? And the first option that would have been given by the people at the time is just find a way to appease God. You have to find a way to appease God. But Job doesn't think like everyone else around him. He maintains not that he hasn't goofed up. He maintains that he is innocent. It's different. He says, not that I haven't accidentally done something. He says, I am innocent. It's a very Israelite way of thinking. And we see here in a conversation that he has with his wife shortly after that first interaction, she says to him, are you still maintaining your integrity? Curse God and die. But Job replies, you are talking like a foolish woman. Shall we accept good from God and not trouble? And in all this, Job did not sin. What he said. Job won't take the first option. He says, it's not about appeasing God. I'm not going to appease him and try to get only good from him. Shouldn't we accept both good and bad? And I am innocent. But we do have our second option here. I don't recommend this option to encourage people who are suffering, but you could encourage them to curse God and die. It's on the table. I have seen people take it. People who have run into so much suffering that they curse God and they choose a path that leads to death. Say, I'd rather have this. It's option number two. Job does not take this one either. And so Job sits in the dirt in suffering, and we see his three friends approach. I'm going to go quickly through these three friends. They're the majority of the book, but we see their most powerful misery or the most powerful ministry right at the beginning. They come up to Job, who is suffering, and they see how bad it is, and for 1 week, they sit with him in silence. This is the high point of the ministry of Job's friends, but they soon open their mouth. And his three friends, to help you keep them straight, you have to know that all three friends are coming from three different perspectives, but they're talking about the same point. And the point they're talking about is called the retribution principle. This is not the great symbiosis. This says that in the end, because God is just, he will punish the wicked and reward the righteous. There will be retribution. And it flips quickly into the inverse, which is incorrect, but they go hand in hand, which is if we see someone being punished or suffering, we can assume they're a sinner. And if we see someone benefiting, we can assume they're righteous. All of this gets lumped together into this principle. And when you think it needs to happen now, that's the strict justice approach, that God will punish people who are wicked now, and he will reward people who are good now. All three friends want to convince Job of this. And so I have here Job on the left. You can see he's sitting there. And on his right are his three friends. You don't really need to remember their names. The first one is Eliphaz. The second is Bildad. And the third is Zophar. And you'll see Eliphaz has a magnifying glass. That's not really time appropriate, but it's going to help you understand his approach. Bildad is reading a scroll, and Zophar is talking about a question mark, but I wanted him to face the other way, so the question mark is backwards. You have to see. Those are the three. And Job starts off, and he says, cursed am I. May the day I was born never have light shine on it again. And his friends decide they are going to try to talk to him. They see him suffering. They all think it's because he's a sinner. Eliphaz is going to make arguments from his experience. Eliphaz is the, I've seen this 1,000 times, approach. As I have observed, those who plow evil and those who sow trouble reap it. Bildad is going to reference tradition. It's a tale as old as time, like Beauty and the Beast. Ask the former generation and ask what their ancestors learned, for we were only born yesterday and know nothing. And Zophar is going to appeal to the mysterious nature of God. Can you fathom the mysteries of God? Can you probe the limits of the Almighty? Three approaches, a three-pronged fork, trying to skewer Job on his own sin. I've seen it 1,000 times before, and maybe you've heard people say that to you when you've been suffering. This is a tale as old as time. Maybe you've heard that before when you're suffering too. And hey, who knows the mysteries of God? Job does not like any of this. He says, if I've done something wrong, tell me. But there's nothing wrong coming out of my mouth. And at one point, he says, you are smearing me with lies. You are worthless physicians. If you would just stop talking, that would be wisdom for you. And they have a 3-round conversation. It's Job, Eliphaz, Job, Bildad, Job, Zophar, 3 times. That's the conversation. And it gets increasingly heated. But as they are going, we see something from Job. This is the thing you're going to hold on to from Job here. Zophar, Bildad, and Eliphaz talk about God. Job seems to be appealing to God. We hear Job say, if only there was someone to mediate between me and God, someone to bring us together. In the second round of conversation, Job says, and this is a beautiful glimpse of the gospel, right in one of the oldest books of the Bible. It says, I know my Redeemer lives, that in the end he will stand on the earth, and after my skin has been destroyed, yet in my flesh I will see God. I myself will see him with my own eyes, I and not another. How my heart yearns within me. His friends are talking about Job. Job's appealing to God. He's also confused. He says God is after him. He says God's not just, but I have no other hope than God. Job is in a state, but his friends press the attack. And those three lines of reasoning by round three have dissolved into three mistakes. All three of them started okay. Bildad, he started off by saying, we know your kids died because they were sinners. I would not start a conversation like that with someone who is suffering. But for the most part, they're saying half-truths about God. But by the end, Eliphaz is saying, Job, you are a sinner. And he's made a list of offenses that he is convinced Job is guilty of. I've seen it before. I know it. I know you've sinned. But Eliphaz is wrong. Bildad, by the end, is not talking about Job at all. His last speech is just about 10 lines about the past. Job is right here, and he's saying things like, dominion and awe belong to God. He establishes order in the heights of heaven. Can his forces be numbered? In the end, how much less than him is a mortal who is but a maggot? It's not wrong, but it has nothing to do with Job anymore. Right? He's now only talking about the tale as old as time. And Job gets nothing from Bildad. And Zophar, I kind of like this. When you start off a conversation with who knows the mysteries of God, there's really nowhere to go after that. And Zophar doesn't even have a third speech. He's silent. Zophar says nothing else anymore. So by the end, these three friends who are convinced Job has sinned are telling him a list of offenses he hasn't done, talking about things that have nothing to do with him, or not talking to him at all. Right, so we see here Job at the end says, as surely as God lives, who has denied me justice, the Almighty who has made my life bitter, as long as I have life within me, the breath of God in my nostrils, my lips will not say anything wicked, and my tongue will not utter lies. I will never admit you are in the right till I die. I will not deny my integrity. I will maintain my innocence and never let go of it. My conscience will not reproach me as long as I live. It's a conversation. It doesn't go well. It's not a good conversation between three friends and Job. And what they have tried to do is our third option when people are suffering. Do we encourage them to admit their guilt? Maybe. Like I said, some of the suffering in my life has come as a result of my own sin. And repentance is a good idea. But we're going to find out here that their insistence that they know Job's sin is not correct. Then we get a fourth person who comes. The fourth person is not mentioned anywhere before this. After he speaks, no one responds to him, and God never gives a verdict on what he says. Elihu shows up, and Elihu talks for a while. Elihu is younger. Here he is showing up with his finger like this because he wants to add something. Elihu has an Israelite name as opposed to the other. And Elihu says, hey, I'm young, but I have something to say. And he represents a fourth option for Job. He says, maybe your suffering's not a punishment. Maybe it's training. Maybe God allows the innocent to suffer, so in the end, they may shine even brighter. Right, that pops in and shows up. He goes on and on. It's a little hard to listen to, but it's a more sophisticated argument presented to Job. And so our fourth option, when people are suffering, you know, we could ask them to appease God. They could curse God and die. They could admit their guilt. They can accept their lesson. But before we know whether this is the right answer or not, the fifth friend appears, the main character of the book of Job, the one who we've needed to hear from the whole time. God arrives in a storm. And God is not impressed with the conversation. He says, who is this that obscures my plans with words without knowledge? And then he goes through a list of things that he knows and Job doesn't. I'll give you just an example here. He says, where were you when I laid the earth's foundation? Tell me if you understand. And he goes through the mating habits of wild animals, the time and location of goats giving birth, He goes through the seasons, he goes through the kamos, and he lays it all out, and he says, if you understand any of this, by all means, interrupt. God is putting his wisdom on full display. And then I'm going to leave the ancient world. I'm going to give you the fifth option here that I think we use when someone is suffering. We sit next down to them and we say, hey, let's try to get God to follow his rules together. Right? That's the modern approach. The modern approach is we have figured out the world. We know God is smart. We know God will follow the rules. He just forgot about them, I guess. We just need to remind him he's in the wrong and he will be forced to admit the brilliance of our position. God, you really don't want to be doing this because it's not smart. It doesn't fit your plans. Right? To that, I almost feel bad saying that out loud because God could show up in a storm and be like, do you know anything about goats at all? And I'd be like, no. Theo came up the other day and he was like, how much does a donkey weigh? I'm like, I don't know. I can't even answer how much a donkey weighs. I think he was wondering if I could pick up a donkey, which I don't think I could, right? But I can't answer that kind of stuff. Yet sometimes I get tempted to someone who's suffering, say, hey, let's sit down and let's reason with God and set him straight. Let's set him straight together. He'll listen to us. He's reasonable. But God is going to shut that down so fast. He shuts it down with two really interesting creatures, and I'm getting near the end here. Thanks for sticking with me. The behemoth and the leviathan, right? Some people think this might be a hippo and a crocodile. I think it's just easiest to understand them as two of the biggest, baddest animals there were. Mythologically fearsome. And God says, all right, you see those two right there? You who thinks that you understand the world, I made those things. Number two, they're actually kind of beautiful. There's parts of them that are actually really well designed. I made them. Number three, if you tried to do anything with them, you would be destroyed. They are way more dangerous than you. And number four, they submit to me in seconds. When I walk by, they submit to me. They beg for their lives from me. And I think what God is saying here is you think you understand Job, but the created world is a big place. Your perspective is too narrow. And I can tell you, I can show you two creatures as an example that the world is not only big and beautiful and impressive and will stagger you when you see it, but it is also wild in some places. And it was never designed with safety as the number one priority. God paints the picture of a world that is not absent of suffering. It's not designed in its current state to not have suffering in it. That if you get in certain situations just because of the way the world is, these creatures, even though they submit to me, they would hurt you. And you would be hurt by them. And Job responds with a long, I'm sorry. It's longer than I'm sorry, but it's actually pretty short. It's one of the shorter speeches here. He's like, I don't know what I was talking about. And there's a line here that I think highlights what I'm going to come back to with the reason why we should emulate Job. One of his great desires in all of the suffering has been satisfied. My ears have heard of you, but now my eyes have seen you. Job responds by highlighting two things. You're right and you're here. And I'm good. I am good. You are right and you are here and I am good. And then God looks at the friends and says, I am angry with you and your two friends, Eliphaz, because you have not spoken the truth about me the way my servant Job has. Which for a second is like, wait a second, what? Because Job hasn't only spoken true words about God. He's overstepped the lines in a couple places. But God says, what Job has been doing is right, and what you have been doing is wrong. And so let me add a sixth option to how do we respond to people who are suffering. We seek God together. And it seems so easy, and I'm sorry, because it is very hard. It is very hard. Everything else looked like something that we could do, convince God. Just admit this and things will go away. Just change this and things will go away. We can choose to die if we want. Right, just accept your lesson. But this one says that may be the right response. Job's posture, even though he doesn't say the right things, he insists on meeting with God. I need to see him. He has stretched his hand against me. I need to see him. Until I see him, I won't understand why any of this is happening. And in the end, God says that Job has spoken rightly. So our two questions. Why does God allow innocent people to suffer? God does not say. He does not say. The opening question that we all initially have, he comes in, he doesn't say, this is why I'm doing what I'm doing. He says, this is who I am. And that's the response we get. That question remains unanswered. We don't know. But how do we respond when we see that suffering, when our plans don't pan out the way that we want? We seek God together. That's the option. Hebrews puts it beautifully. At one point, Job says, if I only had a mediator, and in Hebrews, we see that we do. I'm not going to read the whole verse, but a great priest who has entered the Holy of Holies, who can wash our bodies with pure water. And because of that, we can hold to our faith. And I like what it says at the end here. And let us consider how we may spur one another on towards love and good deeds, not giving up meeting together, as some are in the habit of doing, but encouraging one another, and all the more as you see the day approaching. We have a mediator. We have to encourage each other to go seek him, to seek his will and to do his will. But it is hard. It is hard. One of my favorite things here, I'll end this with this. It's a quote from C.S. Lewis from the Screwtape Letters. In the Screwtape Letters, you have to remember, it's written from the perspective of demons, so the enemy in the Screwtape Letters is God. But they're talking about ways that can get someone off track. And there are points at which there is suffering, and one of them feels pretty good. But the other one responds with this. And I want to kind of highlight this here and kind of pull it together with Job here. But he says, do not be deceived, wormwood, you lesser demon. Our cause is never more in danger than when a human, no longer desiring, but still intending to do our enemy's will, looks around upon a universe from which every trace of him seems to have vanished and asks why he has been forsaken and still obeys. It is powerful to seek God and his will, to seek to obey him in the midst of suffering is powerful. It's dangerous. The world is a dangerous place, and people who seek God in their suffering are more dangerous still. They can do an awful lot of good. I realize, too, that in something here where the end takeaway is to seek God, I have done a lot of talking about him. I have been kind of like the friends, explaining who God is. So I want to pause here at the very end, in the last couple minutes, and say very little, and ask you to just pause, maybe in your suffering, maybe not in a time of suffering for you, and just to seek God. So a couple minutes of prayer, you can just, eyes open or closed, just ask to meet with God. And if you're not sure who to ask, you have a mediator who's very good at bringing you into the presence of God. You can ask Jesus, and he can help. God, you are sovereign over a world that can sometimes cause us pain. And we ask more than anything that as we walk through those times, when the things set before us seem farther away and maybe even impossible to reach, when the plans fall apart, we ask first that you would not leave us. That we would seek you and we would find you. And that you would show us the way to go. We pray these things in the name of your Son who is next to you right now, listening in on this conversation. We pray that in his name. Amen.